The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
Welcome to another exciting edition of Thought Crime Radio. I'm Rich with Patricia on the line. Patricia, you there?
Hi there, I'm here.
All right. So we have a computer programmer and a hypnotherapist talking about politics. That should be interesting. What in the world do they have to do with politics? Well, people who have listened to this show for a while probably have some idea of the angle of this show. Anyway, so today we're going to talk about 9/11. Surprise, surprise. Last Saturday was the 9th anniversary of the 9/11 operation, and we the people are still living in denial. Just asking the most basic questions is likely to elicit a well-conditioned Pavlovian response, a glazing over of the eyes and the usual array of dismissive epithets like conspiracy theorist. But to anyone with a modicum of inquisitiveness, the questions remain. Dick Gregory has started a liquid-only fast until these questions are answered, or until his 80th birthday in 2012. What questions are these? How could three modern skyscrapers symmetrically collapse at virtual freefall speed due to random fires and random structural damage? It hasn't happened before, not even once. It hasn't happened since. Yet it happened three times on that fateful day, even to a building which was never struck by a plane, Building 7. Where was NORAD? What command did Dick Cheney issue in the White House bunker regarding the imminent Pentagon impact, which a junior officer was motivated to question in the presence of Norman Mineta, the former Transportation Secretary? Why have six members of the 9/11 Commission and its chief counsel denounced their own report as based on perjured testimony, while their chair and co-chair go on pretending? What has happened to the mainstream media in this country? On the June 28th show, we pointed out the hard evidence, including eyewitness testimony and local news feeds, that the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City was a false flag operation, apparently conducted by elements of the federal government. This evidence includes the discovery of two unexploded military-grade bombs in the basement of the building, an eyewitness Jane Graham's account of seeing men in GSA uniforms in the basement in possession of black blocks of putty and wire. There's a whole constellation of information, including expert analysis of the blast damage and seismic evidence about this event, which is available on the net for anyone to see. Likewise, the World Trade Center The bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993 was not what it seemed, as Dan Rather attested to on the CBS Evening News.
Last winter, the FBI was praised for its speed in cracking the case of the World Trade Center bombing and bringing four suspects to trial. Now, there is some evidence that the FBI may have known of the plot in advance through an informant and might even have stopped the bombing that killed six people. Correspondent Jacqueline Adams has the story.
FBI agents might have been able to prevent last February's deadly explosion at New York's World Trade Center. They discussed secretly substituting harmless powder for the explosives, but they didn't, according to the FBI's own informant, Imad Salem. Unbeknownst to the FBI at the time, Salem recorded many of his conversations with his handlers.
I'm holding 903 pages of draft transcripts.
William Kunstler represents Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman and several others charged with conspiring to blow up a series of New York City landmarks 4 months after the World Trade Center bombing. That case has not yet gone to trial. Kunstler confirmed newspaper reports of the Salem transcripts. In one, Salem complains to an FBI agent, "Since the bomb went off, I feel terrible. I feel bad. I feel here is people who don't listen." The agent replies, "Hey, I mean, it wasn't like you didn't try and I didn't try. You can't force people to do the right thing."
There is material in here to show gross governmental misconduct.
Today, attorneys for the defendants in the ongoing World Trade Center bombing case formally asked for the transcripts of Salem's tapes.
Quite frankly, it's beyond me why now the fourth week into the trial, we still don't have these materials.
Prosecutors have refused to comment publicly, but legal experts say the defense may have no right to those transcripts.
It's not a defense to a crime to say, if only the government had stopped me, I wouldn't have done it. So this isn't material that ordinarily the defense would be entitled to.
In court today, a witness from the Ford Motor Company linked debris recovered from the explosion site to a Ford van where defendant Mohammed Salamat was arrested less than a week after the bombing. Jacqueline Adams, CBS News, New York.
So, we have a FBI informant who was instructed by his FBI handler to use, to purchase and provide real explosive to the people who were involved in the bombing. I think six people died, if I recall, in that bombing. I think it's fairly much of a silly notion that there's some kind of immunity to the FBI simply because they didn't stop this from happening. Not only did they not stop it, they facilitated it. You know, the actual informant was the purveyor of the explosives. And again, on a previous show, we played a brief clip of a BBC interview regarding the London bombings of 7/7/2005, Britain's 9/11, where it was revealed that a terrorist training exercise was taking place involving bombings at precisely the times and locations of the three bombs that actually went off. And yet again, we pointed out that Robin Cook, the former foreign minister of Britain, had admitted what was already obvious, that Al-Qaeda was created by Western intelligence in Afghanistan in the 70s in order to lure the Soviet Union into their own Vietnam, as Brzezinski put it in an interview with a French newspaper. The very name of the group, Al-Qaeda, means the database in Arabic, reflecting its bureaucratic origins. The Nazi-controlled media in this country has yet to ask the obvious question of exactly when or indeed if the CIA ever spun off Al-Qaeda after investing many millions of dollars in them. Al-Qaeda's crowning achievement, 9/11, was either a miracle from Allah or an inside job, either a physical impossibility or a measure of the depth of corruption in Washington. There are no other alternatives. When the impossible is ruled out, only the highly improbable remains. Here is a show which was broadcast on KPFA in Berkeley eons ago. As far as I know, this is the first comprehensive airing of these issues in Colombia. Such is the mind control exercised among the unconscious slaves of America who think they are free.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear, yeah.
society is mesmerized by this myth, this official story of 9/11 being due to the Muslims. Everyone knows it. You can't challenge this myth. If you do, you're a conspiracy kook. Well, I'm sorry. Good science cuts through all that nonsense. It doesn't care. When I analyze these samples of previously molten metal, and I see iron and fluorine and manganese in abundance, it doesn't care whether I'm conservative or liberal, Republican, Democrat, Green. It doesn't care. It's just an experiment that's done. It's objective. To have people just say, I don't want to see the data. I don't want you to challenge the official story, which everyone knows, you know. That is just so contrary to science, to logic, to reason, to humanity.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Stephen Jones. Today's show, Thermite, a case for 9/11 controlled demolition. Dr. Jones has taught physics at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah for 21 years. In late 2005, he published a scientific paper, Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Collapse?, in which he called for a serious investigation of the hypothesis that World Trade Center 7 and the Twin Towers were brought down not just by impact damage and fires, but through the use of prepositioned cutter charges. In his paper, Dr. Jones considers the official FEMA, NIST, and 9/11 Commission reports that fires plus impact damage alone caused the complete collapses of all three buildings. He presents evidence for the controlled demolition hypothesis, which is suggested by the available data, testable and falsifiable, and yet has not been analyzed in any of the reports funded by the U.S. government. I began this interview with Dr. Stephen Jones in Chicago at the 9/11 International Education and Strategy Conference on June 4, 2006, and we concluded our discussion in Los Angeles at the American Scholars Symposium on June 26, 2006. Dr. Stephen Jones, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
Dr. Jones, you teach physics at the graduate level at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. Could you describe what exactly your field of expertise is and what it is that you teach?
All right. Well, I teach Physics 121, which is principles of Newtonian mechanics for scientists and engineers. I teach physical science. I've taught, and this could come up again any time, I'm sure, electromagnetism, archaeometry at the graduate level, and we also had a course on quarks and leptons at the graduate level. Mostly now I'm teaching Newtonian mechanics, which is an undergraduate course, and a lot of fun working with the students on conservation of momentum and so on, which does relate to the study of what actually brought the towers down, the World Trade Center towers.
Could you tell us what archaeometry is?
Yeah. Archaeometry is essentially the application of advanced physics and other scientific methods to archaeology. So we have artifacts from some site. We want to know what happened at the site. We apply physics techniques like X-ray fluorescence, proton-induced X-ray emission. We have a whole range of techniques available to help us sort out what went on at this site. And, of course, that's what we're doing at 9/11. We want to know what really happened. And so it is archaeometry. We have certain artifacts, certain samples, in other words, from the site, and visual now. That's unusual in archaeology. I mean, to have actual visual evidence from the event that you're trying to study, in this case 9/11. There's a lot of video and photographic evidence.
I first wanted to ask you what your initial reaction was on September 11th, 2001. Did you have any questions about what was happening there, the official story? What was your reaction when you saw the towers come down?
Yeah, well, actually, on the morning of September 11th, I was watching some TV. I was rushing to get to the university, But I suppose, like most everybody else, I was quite shocked and awed by the collapse of the towers. I did have at least one class that day. Of course, we discussed the matter some there, but it wasn't until I saw the collapse of Building 7 that it struck me, this is very strange. I mean, this is non-physical for this building to collapse straight down, just caused by random fires and damage. And it fell very rapidly, too, when I measured the speed of the fall with students.
When was it that you saw the collapse of World Trade Center 7?
Yeah, well, see, that wasn't until much later. It would have been actually in 2005, the first part of 2005.
So then it was almost 4 years after the events of September 11th that you began to question the official story?
That's really true. I'm sort of a Johnny-come-lately, actually. Once I saw the collapse of Building 7, I dived in and started doing analyses. And fortunately, I came across Jim Hoffman's website as I began to study this. And Jim has done a tremendous job of research, and he provides references, which I like, because then I can go and check things for myself, you know. For instance, on the sulfidation of steel, it's a technical term, but it's very puzzling. This sulfidation was found both in World Trade Center 7 steel as well as in Towers steel, and what it means is that somehow sulfur had formed a eutectic. In other words, the steel had melted at high temperature. Now, this is beyond what the fires can be expected to do, way beyond that. And here's a very high temperature and formation of a eutectic with sulfur. That, it turns out, fits completely with this research I've done on thermite. But at the time, I thought, man, I've got to check this. So I read the original paper. Some professors out in Massachusetts had published a short paper on the sulfidation. New York Times had covered it too, so this is the greatest mystery uncovered so far, and wasn't even mentioned in the NIST report, you know, or the 9/11 Commission, as far as I could see in that report. It's quite a tome, you know, you have to wade through. But there it is, and so I guess the point is, as how I got into this, I was nudged by a number of people to study it. But it was when I saw the collapse of Building 7, and then I got into the research done by Jim Hoffman, and things just started falling into place. Boom, 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 you know. And like they say about the explosions in the towers, boom, 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 boom. Well, these data just fit together and point very strongly to an inside job. You see, it's not just the planes hitting the towers. And of course, Building 7 was not even hit by a plane, so its collapse, it's a great stretch right there that it would fall because of the hijackers.
Dr. Jones, you mentioned the word eutectic. What does that mean?
Eutectic is a mixture that lowers the melting point. So, for example, with ice, it melts typically at 32 degrees. You get warmer than that, it melts. Steel melts at 1,510 centigrade. I'd have to look that up in my paper. What that is, I'm so used to working now in centigrade, but it's around 2,500 Fahrenheit, roughly. But when you add sulfur to steel, now it will melt around 900 centigrade. If you have a high temperature enough so that the sulfur will penetrate into the steel, you see? And then now it will melt quickly. So this is an area that I have researched. How do you reach these high temperatures in the structural steel with the presence of sulfur in such a way as to cut through the steel? Well, what I found out very quickly, and this is with others in the Scholars for 9/11 Truth Group, I must give credit, you know, because we're talking about this on the forum, you know, and trying to figure out these questions. But it turns out there's a form of thermite called thermate in which sulfur and potassium permanganate are added to the thermite. And when that is done, then you get this eutectic formation in the steel where the sulfur enters in and then the steel just melts. It's like a hot knife cutting through butter. A hot knife, you know, it's not just the pressure, it's melting actually the butter as you go through. This is what's happening with the sulfur added to thermite. I know this is a bit technical, but the point is that as we look at these data, I mean, everything just fits like a glove. I can mention other evidences for thermite in these towers, too.
Now, you speak of melted steel.
Yes.
But most people are saying, well, you know, the temperatures were not hot enough to melt steel. So are you speaking more specifically about how the steel was sliced? I mean, you're not saying that all the steel was melted.
That's absolutely correct. Now, you see, we have to be real careful here. The fires in the World Trade Center buildings were certainly not hot enough to melt the structural steel. Now, this is agreed on by NIST scientists and others, Professor Eager and so on. We all agree those fires were not hot enough to melt steel. Nevertheless, there is evidence that eutectic formed with sulfur. And then there's even evidence, as Professor Barnett pointed out, for evaporated steel. Now, steel evaporates at is around 2860 centigrade. Fahrenheit, I'm sorry, I don't use too much. It's something around 4,500 Fahrenheit. So, but I mean, 2860 centigrade is where steel evaporates. Now, you can't possibly reach those temperatures, you see, with the fires in the World Trade Center buildings, but you can reach those temperatures with thermite. Now, here's a distinction that I try to emphasize. The thermite reaction produces molten iron at a high temperature. Molten iron, it's white-hot molten iron. Not molten steel, the product is molten iron. Now, that molten iron combined with sulfur is what will cut through steel. It melts, yes, it melts its way through the structural steel. And it's hot enough, this thermite, that you can actually evaporate some steel. And this is what's observed, the sulfidation of the steel, the evaporation. And then we've now looked at some samples of the previously molten metal, and we find iron in abundance. This is not molten aluminum. That was one, explanation that fell by the wayside now, because our experiments have shown this is not molten aluminum. It's yellow hot and white hot, and we have measured now the composition of this previously molten metal in two instances, abundant iron. And the result is still preliminary on the sulfur and the manganese, but we do see these elements in this previously molten material. I mean, all these evidences point to thermite. And there's more evidences even, that I haven't even mentioned, but that are mentioned in my paper online. Now, when I say the results are preliminary with regard to molten iron, that's not going to change. It's the quantity. Yeah, we're working now on quantifying, and that takes careful calibration and analysis to finish this up and to say, well, there's so much iron percentage, so much sulfur, so much manganese, so much potassium. And, of course, that's what I'll be working on in the next several weeks.
Now, could you tell us exactly what thermite is and what the difference is between thermite and thermate?
Sure.
And also, in terms of the molten metal that was found below the surface, below the towers, mm-hmm. were you able to get any samples of that and test it?
Yeah. See, you're catching on to the chemistry here and the terminology. That's great. Okay, thermite is a mixture of aluminum powder and iron oxide powder. And this is a well-known reaction. I have demonstrated it with a colleague from chemistry in my class, for instance, and I will be demonstrating it this fall again. I mean, it's routinely demonstrated at universities. I think a lot of your listeners, if they've taken a chemistry or, well, physical science also a class, they might well have seen the thermite reactions. It's very impressive, very hot, a bright white flash, and molten iron comes out, you see, and then this white ash, which is aluminum oxide. So again, the composition, well-known, is aluminum powder and iron oxide powder. Now, that's thermite. There are variations on thermite. One of the principal variations is called thermate, and that involves the addition of sulfur and potassium permanganate, hence the manganese in the residue. And those are added to the thermite. And now this material, when it's reacted, will cut through steel very rapidly, more rapidly than ordinary thermite.
I'm speaking with physicist and co-founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, Dr. Stephen Jones. Today's show, Thermite, a Case for 9/11 Controlled Demolition. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, what form does thermate come in? Is it a powder or liquid? What is it?
Oh, typically a powder, yeah. And so I talked about this yesterday, actually, in my talk. And again, this is one of the scholars on Scholars for 9/11 Truth. He did some research. So we're all wondering, well, how could they, whoever did this, use thermite? There's abundant evidence, as I've said, or thermate, okay. I'll just say thermite because there's so many variations of which thermate is one. So how could they get the thermite to actually be positioned in such a way that it would cut through the steel columns, which is traditionally done with monomolecular explosives like TNT, RDX, HMX. But in this case, we have all this evidence for thermite. So how would they do that with thermite? Well, There's an invention that goes back to the 90s. It's been patented.
Last winter, yeah.
And what it is a cylinder. If you can imagine a cylinder, you can make it whatever length you need. Some of these columns are 3 feet wide, you know, of steel. And you load the cylinder with thermite, and then there's a linear groove along one side. So if you imagine a cylinder and then a groove along this side, and there's a nozzle that sticks out a ways. Now, what happens? And then you put that nozzle against the steel. And it's described in the patent in some detail. When the thermite is made to ignite, which isn't easy, by the way, and we have done experiments on this at BYU, how do you ignite thermite? But anyway, so when the thermite is ignited, you have this molten iron with sulfur, if you have added sulfur, and that molten iron comes out through this groove. It blasts its way out, actually, and now it's just, it really is very much like a white hot knife. Quite literally, it's molten liquid iron at white hot temperature. You can imagine what, and that just slices through the steel, especially when you have sulfur added, and it just cuts right through the steel very rapidly. So we found this invention is out there, and certainly the technique for using thermite to bring these buildings down is available.
Now, have you considered how this thermite could have been applied, for instance, to the Twin Towers? Would it have to have been applied to the steel core columns? And assuming they're all covered, how would the thermite be applied? And secondly, I want to know, how did you get onto thermite? Is this typically used in a building demolition?
Mm-hmm. Let me start with the second question. First, I got onto thermite because first I learned about the molten metal pools. And this data I mentioned from the metallurgists in Massachusetts, the sulfidation at high temperatures of the steel, those two pieces of data combined suggest thermite very strongly with sulfur added. Then when I saw the molten metal pouring out of the South Tower, we haven't even mentioned that yet. That's even additional evidence and probably the strongest, well, certainly among the strongest evidences we have for thermite. You see this molten metal pouring out of the South Tower just minutes before its collapse, and at the very corner where you see twisting, then in just minutes. Now the question of how would they do this, of course, now we have to get into speculation a bit, because how they could have done it is one thing, but until someone confesses. But these people that were loading in the thermite incendiary would need to have access to the central columns, which you would obtain, I presume, through the elevator shafts. It's not like a person riding the elevator would see this. This would be in the columns behind. But once you had access into that region, then, of course, you could work, and a person could apply these cylinders filled with thermite to the steel columns.
I see. So the thermite would be contained within a cylinder, right, made out of what material?
The cylinder has to be able to withstand high temperatures for a while, and so tungsten is the metal of choice. Actually, ceramic would work also, because ceramic can stand these very high temperatures.
Okay, so let's say that the thermite is in a tungsten cylinder, and it is somehow attached to the columns, so that it wouldn't explode until whoever was doing this wanted it to explode. So how would it be exploded to bring the building down?
Yeah. Again, the scholars have looked into these questions. These are great questions, and they arise naturally. So it turns out, I need to explain a variation on thermite called superthermite now to answer that question. We're learning lots of physics and chemistry here. Not something, by the way, that structural engineers would ordinarily consider, but someone with a broad background. I do have a fairly broad background because of my work in archaeometry. And so now we can bring that to bear on these questions. So, superthermite is a mixture of, again, aluminum powder and iron powder. The difference is that it's extremely fine, less than about 120 nanometers for these particles of aluminum and iron oxide. Now, when you mix the extremely fine particles of aluminum and iron oxide together and get that to react, it explodes. So, see, the ordinary thermite, the more coarse, is still fine, but the more, of course, mixture will burn in seconds, but without an explosion. That's called an incendiary. If you want an explosion, then you go to the super fine, ultra fine powders, and now it's explosive. Now, there are what are called super thermite matches. And these are, you can just look on the Los Alamos National Lab website, and they brag about their development of these matches. I mean, they're used in fireworks. This is not, I guess it is rocket science at some level, but, you know, at least firework science. But anyway, so these super thermite matches have this super thermite that I described encapsulated with wires going into the capsule. So what you do then is you send an electric current through the super thermite. The super thermite ignites, and that in turn will set off thermite or any variation of thermite that you, like super thermite or thermate that you have. So there's all these variations. It's really quite a remarkable high energy density compound. It's, well, I mean, you can buy this stuff on eBay. It's not like it's a secret, you know. And as I say, demonstrated in universities all over. So anyway, now there's one other element then. So once you've got these super thermite matches that can be triggered electrically, then what you do is you have a radio signal to say, okay, now send the current through the thermite, super thermite match that will ignite your thermite charge. And now you can, through radio control, from a distance, without, you know, a lot of wires, then just radio controlled, you can set off these cutter charges at will.
How does a radio signal ignite the super thermite? How does that work?
The radio signal sends your signal to a radio receiver. So a certain code, you send it to this receiver, it picks it up. That in turn will trigger an electric current. For instance, with a relay. So you trigger a current now. So it's not the radio wave itself that sets off the super thermite match, but rather the radio signal is used to close a relay to send a current through the, and there's various ways to do that, but to generate a current that goes through the super thermite match. And then it's quite straightforward, really. It's what you do, you can do this with fireworks. You can set those off with a radio signal. And instead of the firework, you put your thermite there, you see. Quite spectacular. That would be quite spectacular. Now, let me foresee a question that I often get asked, and that is, how come the explosions occurred right near where the planes went in? Now, granted, it's about an hour or so later that you see these explosions, but how could you arrange to have explosions where the planes went in? I mean, so that it would look like the planes an hour later somehow caused these explosions. Well, you see, that's fairly straightforward. A person then would simply arrange to have a number of thermite charges placed in the building at different floors and levels so that after the plane goes in, now you program your computer, okay, we're going to start then at floor 80, you know, South Tower. That's right near where the plane went in. And it's just at about floor 80 that we see this thermite flowing out of the building just before the collapse of the building. It's quite dramatic.
Yes, I was going to ask you how the collapse could have been synchronized. Then are you implying that it could have been done or would have been done with a computer?
Sure, yeah. There's no doubt that, a computer would be used to send out the signal. So once you know where the plane goes in, now you program, we'll start at floor 80, and here's the sequence. The sequence would have been calculated, of course, before. It takes weeks, actually, to bring a building down symmetrically. I mean, it's easy to get a building to topple over, you know. But as I've read about controlled demolition, I interviewed a demolition expert to learn more. I mean, these guys take weeks and software, and it takes a lot of work to pull off a controlled demolition in such a way that the building comes straight down as opposed to just tipping over and wiping out buildings all around. That's the way the buildings came down, right? It is pretty much straight down. In particular, Building 7 is a beautiful demolition. I mean, it came straight down onto its footprint. And as I read these demolition expert said, wow, it looked like a controlled demolition to me. This is right after 9/11, you know, before it became verboten to talk about explosives and controlled demolition. But early on, these guys are saying, yeah, it really did look like an implosion. That's the term they use, where you bring the building straight down onto its footprint.
I'm speaking with physicist and co-founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, Dr. Stephen Jones. Today's show, Thermite, a case for 9/11 controlled demolition. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So, we're midway through the show. Hopefully we can wedge this all into an hour. Are you listening, Patricia?
Yes.
It's a good interview, isn't it?
Yes, I love her. She's good.
Yeah, she's real good.
And Jones is good.
Yeah. I need to play a PSA here, and I'll be right back.
This program brought to you by listener support and a donation from Thumper Entertainment, headlining the Locust Street Stage for the 4th Annual 2010 Boone County National Bank's Roots and Blues and Barbecue Festival on Friday, October 1st at 9 p.m., veteran bluesman Tab Benoit. And on Saturday, October 2nd at 9 p.m., 13-time Grammy Award-winning artist Dan Tominski. More schedule information and tickets available at rootsandbluesandbbq.com.
Okay. So let's get back into this show, and with any luck, we'll have some time before the hour ends to discuss some of this.
Now, in a commercial controlled demolition, is thermite used, or do they use something else?
Yeah. See, in a conventional demolition, no, you would use HMX, RDX, these monomolecular explosives. So the trick is here, and this is on the internet too. There are tags that are added by the manufacturers, and this is required by law, I understand, so that when these explosives are set off, now there's a residual, a tracer, a tag that says, oh, this is manufactured by Acme Explosive Company. We go to Acme and we say, who bought this, you know, and so on. You see, you can trace back who is responsible. With thermite, you don't have those tags, you see. It's very clever, really. And, of course, another thing about thermite is the end products, you see, is molten iron and aluminum oxide. Well, iron and aluminum are typically found in buildings. It's a little tricky then to sort out, was this from thermite or something in the building? However, when you have sulfidation of structural steel at high temperature and you have previously molten metal that shows sulfur in it, high iron content, but otherwise it really doesn't look like steel. I mean, maybe there's a little component, but it's mostly this iron, which is the product of thermite plus sulfur. You say, wow, these guys used sulfur added to thermite. In other words, thermate in significant quantities to bring these buildings out. Things are fitting together like a glove. Now, I get asked, are you 100% sure? And as a scientist, I have to say, look, in science, it's hard to be 100%, you know, about things. And we continue to study. I'm just saying that the data, all these data elements, point very strongly to controlled demolition. I mean, yes, I'm really confident of that conclusion. Now, last November, it was more, wow, there's all these points. We need to investigate this. Well, we have been investigating it diligently. And now the conclusion is very strong. Of course, we'll continue, you know. And but when you have our experiments, which we added sulfur to thermite and set that off, and yes, we observed, which is in the literature, how quickly this cuts through steel. I mean, a fraction of a second in our case, the steel was eaten through, cut through. And then you have the results out of Massachusetts, Worcester Polytechnic Institute, as I recall, these professors and metallurgists there. The same result with actual steel from WTC-7 and the towers now melted through with sulfidation at high temperatures. I mean, hello, all of this points to thermite used to pull off a controlled demolition.
Just a point of clarification. So the evidence of the composition of the molten metal in the pits, the iron and the sulfur, etc., was that data found in the NIST report or the FEMA report? How do people know
because so much evidence was destroyed, most of it, what the composition of this molten metal was.
Yeah, you know, that's a toughie because, as you say, this material was destroyed. The structural steel was shipped to China and Asia. In this case, the FEMA report does include in Appendix C this discussion by Professor Barnett and others of the sulfidation at high temperature of the structural steel, you see, which points to a cutting agent, and thermate is implied here. There may be others that would result in sulfidation, but then we have this other evidence for the thermite derivatives. But no, it's not so easy just to get a sample. In our case, we had to scramble working with people in New York who had obtained samples. I mean, the provenience is fairly good on these samples, but these are not obtained through official channels. I mean, it's very difficult even to get photographs from the NIST, you know. I mean, our group, our colleagues have asked for release. They say they may release some photographs, but not all. They say they're not going to release the Building 7 photographs until they finish, whenever that is, the analysis of Building 7. Well, that's been delayed, and I mean, why wouldn't they give us the data? Can't we look at it too as scientists? I mean, let's open this up. Let's be transparent. Let's be a society in which the First Amendment and freedom of information are respected, you see. Unfortunately, that's not being done.
Could you describe exactly how the collapse happens, at what angle the columns need to be sliced, and how the building actually is able to fall down on top of itself?
Yeah, let me approach that. In ordinary controlled demolitions, then the company will go in and weaken, actually cut the columns at lower levels before setting off explosives at higher levels. And this is to ensure that the building does collapse straight down. I mean, after all, these solid columns up through the center of most of these steel frame high-rises provide resistance to falling straight down, right? I mean, these enormous steel columns, so you have to cut them down low. And in this case, we have evidence for, and again, this is photographic evidence now, but eyewitness evidence too, like William Rodriguez, of a cutting action on these columns down deep in the basement long before, hour before, in Rodriguez's case, roughly an hour before the buildings finally did collapse. So this weakening would take place in the columns. Now, what we have for photographic evidence, I wish I could show this over the radio, but it is available at various places online. But what you have is a photograph, more than one, but in particular, this one column, which has been cut at about a 45-degree angle. So not straight across, but 45-degree angle. And you can see now the molten metal residue on the outside and on the inside of the column. Now the trick is, on this, this evidence fits in with the others for the use of thermite specifically to cut through these central core columns. And by cutting at a 45-degree angle, now there is just not support for the huge column above, not much. I mean, it will now easily slide off under a provocation, you see, such as a pressure of things falling from above.
I see. So the columns would be sliced at an angle so that they would slide off of each other.
That's right. So later, as the building begins to collapse, this column then would slide off the support below. Yeah.
I see. Could you talk a little bit about the color of the fires and the flashes and the molten metal that is visible in the video?
Of course, the study of these samples is in conjunction with the visual evidence, which is quite abundant, that we have the videographic and the photographic evidence of the immense quantities of yellow-hot molten metal pouring out of the South Tower just minutes before its collapse. I mean, this is even discussed in the NIST report. Now, in addition, I should add, though, that NIST said, well, this could be aluminum. That was their guess. But we have ruled out aluminum. We've done experiments with molten aluminum. We heat the steel pan to yellow, white-hot temperature, yellow-hot, essentially, for the bulk of the pan. And as we pour out the aluminum, which is inside at this same temperature, close to it, the aluminum, as it pours out, is still silvery. I mean, it looks like aluminum foil, basically, and in daylight conditions. which is what we had at the World Trade Center, of course. So this material pouring out of the building, as I first saw that, and as I learned that NIST said, well, this could be aluminum, I said, no. You need more than just structural engineers. You need someone who's familiar with molten aluminum, which I had worked with previously, but not at yellow hot temperature. So we heat up the steel pan. It gets yellow. It incandesces yellow, as you would expect. And actually, the aluminum incandesces, but it's just very faint. So as you pour the aluminum out of the pan, the aluminum with high reflectivity and very low emissivity, which means very low emittance of this incandescent light, it still looks silvery, it still looks aluminum colored. That's my experience, and my colleague who's used molten aluminum for many years, Wes Lifferth, said, yeah, it's silvery, you know, silvery straw, gray color at all temperatures as you pour it out in daylight conditions. So the conclusion is that this molten material, this molten metal flowing out of the building in large quantities, just before the collapse, could not be molten aluminum. And furthermore, it comes from floor 80, 81, right there. And therefore, this is the region and the corner at which we see collapse ensuing. Furthermore, you see a white flare just before the appearance of the molten metal. And this white flare with a white ash floating away, well, again, those are signature characteristics of thermite. Thermite is a reaction of aluminum powder and iron oxide powder or some other metal oxide. And the reaction has this characteristic, this extremely bright white flare, the white ash, and then you see the yellow, white-hot, flowing molten iron coming out of the thermite reaction. All these characteristics are there.
You have written this incredible paper, Why Indeed Did the World Trade Center Buildings Collapse? You discuss 13 examples that show controlled demolition. And what are those 13 examples?
All right, well, let's look at the at these points then in my paper, and I hope people will actually take the opportunity to read the paper, Why Indeed Did the WTC Buildings Collapse, which is available. The easiest way to find it is just to Google on Stephen Jones Thermite. That'll be the first thing that pops up, I'm sure. But the first point has to do with the molten metal observed flowing out of the South Tower and found in pools beneath both towers and World Trade Center 7. And, of course, we've discussed that at some length. The second point has to do with sulfidation observed in structural steel found both at World Trade Center 7 and in recovered structural steel from the towers area. And both of these samples show very high temperature attack of the steel from some agent that was at high temperature and contained sulfur. So point number three has to do with the rapid and symmetrical and complete collapse of World Trade Center 7. And that is discussed in my paper, but it's discussed at greater length and certainly with mathematical precision, much more than I have done here. A paper by Professor Ken Cutler, professor of mathematics at Brigham Young University, much to my surprise. He presented this paper to me, and I, of course, was thrilled to read it. And it discusses the collapse of World Trade Center 7 and how fast it collapses. That's my point number three, but he's written a paper on this now, much better than my point number three. And this paper is available in the Journal of 9/11 Studies. com online.
I'm speaking with physicist and co-founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, Dr. Stephen Jones. Today's show, Thermite, a case for 9/11 controlled demolition. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And Professor Jones, what is your point number four?
Point number four has to do with the fact that no previous skyscraper, these high-rise steel frame buildings, had ever collapsed before due to fire. Very important point. The squibs, this is the point of the plumes of dust and debris being ejected far below the demolition region or the pulverization region, the early drop of the North Tower. This is something we've looked at. I point out here that it's one of those areas, it's not the most important point, certainly, but if NIST would just release the videos and photos that they have, which they have about 300 hours of videos and over 6,000 photographs, it was reported in various publications that the North Tower had an antenna, and the antenna moved down first, just momentarily, but first moved down. Yeah, surprising thing, if the official story is correct. So it needs further study. Eyewitness accounts, lots of eyewitness accounts of loud explosions and flashes, not just up where the planes went in, but down on lower levels. The ejection of steel beams and these debris plumes upward and outward from the towers, indicating explosives. The rapid collapse, conservation of momentum and energy. This is discussed in a paper in the Journal of 9/11 Studies by mechanical engineer Gordon Ross. He takes it much further than I take it in my paper. So skip that section, read Gordon Ross's paper. but he really does a bang-up job on that. Controlled demolition implosions require skill, point number 10, right, as pointed out by demolition experts. Demolishing a building so that it collapses straight down into its own footprint, this feat requires such skill that only a handful of demolition experts in the world will attempt it. It's not easy to get a building to fall straight down like that. And yet Building 7 and the towers, but Building 7 is such a beautiful example.
So you can listen to the rest of this interview. I'll put a link on thoughtcrimeradio.net. Basically, this is from a. It was broadcast on KPFA in Berkeley, I think, in 2007. It's a recording of the. What's the name of the show? Guns and Butter.
Guns and Butter.
Guns and Butter with Bonnie Faulkner. These issues have been widely talked about throughout the world for years now. And it has yet to have a reasonable hearing here in the Nazi-controlled United States. And I use that word Nazi advisedly. The cover-ups that have gone on since at least World War II and before in the United States are truly, definitely prove Chomsky's thesis that things are not as they seem in this country. Let me just play something from Press TV, a recent broadcast there.
For this to happen, all 47...
On the hills of the anniversary of 9/11, architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth say the American public has been fed a storyline about what happened on 9/11/2001, when reportedly 19 Al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked four commercial passenger jet airliners and crashed into the twin towers of the World Trade Center in New York City, killing everyone on board and many others working in the buildings.
The official story is a lie. It's a fraud.
Architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth say critically important evidence regarding the destruction of three World Trade Center towers has emerged, showing preset explosives were used in the demolition of the buildings.
There had to be explosives. There's no other way for the building to come down symmetrically straight down. Like a tree, if you cut into the tree, it falls to the side that you cut.
The Twin Towers suffered total destruction in 10 to 14 seconds in near free fall accelerations. Experts here say that can only occur as a result of preset demolition explosives.
Once we take the blinders off, we can see. There's very few people in America who have taken the blinders off. So we're assisting people by showing them the evidence.
The group also asserts that molten metal was found post the 9/11 inquiry.
Jet fuel and office fires cannot melt iron or steel. They don't get even half as hot as that. And so something else was there that's very energetic material that had to be placed throughout the buildings.
How could they be so bold as to pull the largest crime, the crime of the century, really, and expect to get away with it? And in fact, they did.
If there is a responsible party, it ends with Bush and comes down to Cheney, and then comes down through the military and the various bureaucracies that come. No question, this kind of activity goes to the very top.
Finally, architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth are calling on U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder to request a federal grand jury investigation into this alleged cover-up. For Press TV, Rhonda Pence, Washington.
We are living in pre-Nazi Germany, people. The shock doctrine, which has already been imposed in countries around the world, has finally come home. The Germans didn't think it was possible. They were an advanced civilization with a rich culture of self-governance undergoing an economic crisis. The same type of crisis this country is facing, at the hands of the same institutions, as it turns out. And while the money monsters who print money into existence go through the motions of saving us from the catastrophe that they engineered and are profiting from at enormous taxpayer expense, and larger numbers of people become desperate for a strong man to save the day, Obama fiddles, and the media remains silent, as they were silent when the son and grandson of a Nazi war criminal and money launderer, who was involved in an attempted military coup against the U.S. government, took office as presidents of the United States. Meanwhile, the so-called political leadership of both the left and the right have completely collapsed, from the national level right down to Columbia, Missouri. No one wants to be branded a conspiracy theorist. This is an indication of the level of mind control taking place among the unconscious slaves of America, where 75% of the men actually carry the ancient Egyptian mark and instrument of slavery, circumcision. If you don't think you're a victim of mass deception, all you need to do is look between your legs. Truth is truly a stranger than any fiction. I, for one, am not bashful about calling 9/11 what it was, an act of high treason and mass murder, for which the culprits are still at large. But their secret empire, based on bribery, blackmail, and deception, is crumbling around them. A simple but profound economic revelation is spreading around the world, the secret of money creation, the secret which has purchased otherworldly power for a few pathological elites and their courtesans. For God's sake, wake up, people, so you can at least consciously choose between freedom and slavery when you must make the choice. The terrorists' only tool is fear. They are totally impotent without it. Truth is a wonderful antidote to fear, and it's spreading like wildfire. The future generations need you to start paying attention. The matrix is crumbling around you. Isn't it long past time to check out the red pill? That's my spiel on 9/11. About 9/11.
Yay.
Yay, me.
Can you hear my hands clap?
Yeah, that's good, great.
I watched the most poignant video this weekend that I've ever seen on 9/11. It's on YouTube, and it says WTC photos 9/11- not for children. And it is the most poignant video I've seen yet. It just has the most beautiful photos and sentiments, and also some real cutting through the BS lines, such as a man who was watching as the second World Trade Center was hit by an explosive, but he did not see a plane. So that is a really nice video. I liked it a lot. There's so much information on the internet, Rich. It's just incredible. You know, it's not a secret anymore.
No.
This was a secret on the first day, perhaps, but that was it.
It's only a secret to the willfully blind, the people who simply can't be bothered to investigate these issues for themselves. I mean, what can
you
say?
Well, it's so scary, you know. It's scary to
think
that.
It's not scary because
maybe your government's been taken over. So, you know, you can have some compassion for people who haven't really checked it out, because
it's really scary. But the thing is, when you realize that the entire thing is based on a lie, and the lie is collapsing around them, it's, you know, these people are paper tigers. You know, they're going to go down, and they'll probably destroy this economy in the process, but with any luck, the thing that arises will be better than what we had before, certainly without the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, it's an evolution.
Yeah.
And it's time for all the abuse to end.
Yeah.
And for everyone who's been abused in any way to be free of that.
Exactly. So.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. It's time for the next show, and I'm going to sign off. Thank you, Patricia, so much.
Bye-bye. Bye, Rich. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.